Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today I'm broadcasting from Zion Canyon Mesa in Springdale. And I'll be talking later in the program with Zion Canyon Mesa Executive Director Logan Hebner. His resume includes co-founder of Greenbox, author of Southern Paiute, A Portrait, founder of the Bitten Spur Restaurant, and founder of International Legislative Exchange. In this part of the program, I'm welcoming in Springdale Mayor Barbara Bruno. We're going to talk about challenges and successes facing this gateway community and how changes at Zion National Park are affecting residents and visitors, also future hopes and plans. Barbara Bruno, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on the broadcast. Good to be here in Springdale.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day in Springdale.
Beautiful, beautiful day. So I want to start with you. Tell me a little bit about yourself prior to coming to Springdale.
I'm a native of Utah, born and raised in Price, Utah, and moved to Salt Lake City in 1972 and lived there most of my career. Did spend 7 years on the East Coast.
All right. So, some time in Salt Lake?
Yeah, lots of time in Salt Lake.
And yeah.
I have an undergraduate degree from Westminster College in business, and I have an MBA from the University of Utah.
So okay. All right.
Very Salt Lake focused.
Very Salt Lake focused. We'll have you moving a little closer to the microphone there. Yeah. So what brought you to Springdale?
Well, my husband and I met in 2000 in Salt Lake City, and we pretty quickly realized that we were both big fans of Zion National Park. So 3 years later, we got married. We sold two houses and bought one together and invested in a little house in Tocqueville, which was what we could afford that was in the Zion National Park area. And then in 2012, late 2012, we bought a house here in Springdale and knew from that time on that this would be where we would retire. And we moved here full time in May of 2019 after I retired from corporate America. Mm-hmm. Worked there for 45 years for various large corporations.
Huh. So this might be obvious, but what drew you to Zion? You said you knew you were going to retire here. What attracted you about Zion?
It's a magical place for us. We do a lot of hiking. We've done a lot of canyoneering. My husband still does a lot. I do a little bit, and there's just something about the place that we find magical. We did quite a bit of camping at the Watchman Campground before we bought the house, and always felt good to be here.
Yeah. Tell me about canyoneering. I have a vague understanding of what that is.
Yeah. Canyoneering is where you, instead of climbing up a canyon, you're going down, which involves rappelling around obstacles and
okay.
using some ropes and harnesses. And it's kind of a hike with ropes and harnesses.
I guess. Okay. Right. Yeah. Some adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. So you came 2019, you said, right?
Yes. May of 2019.
So Tocqueville, let's, cause I'm wondering about affordability, right? Even today, right? Yeah, I imagine right downtown Springdale is more expensive than Tocqueville.
Yes. The town of Springdale is pretty expensive. Part of that is because we're so landlocked. There's not a lot of land available and not a lot of houses available, but all of Washington County has become pretty unaffordable for a lot of people. So when we bought our house in Tocqueville, it was not that way. It was during a downturn. And I think now that house would probably not be affordable.
Yeah. How far is Tocqueville away?
It's about 20 miles.
Oh, 20 miles away, yeah.
It's at exit 17 off of I-15.
Okay. So the further you go out, a little more affordable. But you're saying all of Washington County has gotten a bit expensive.
It has.
Yeah.
I think the median home price in Washington County now is almost 6,000.
Yeah.
600,000.
I guess a lot of people want to move to Washington County. Is that what's happening? Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of people moving in, a lot of big families that are here too.
Yeah. Yeah. What about people who work in Springdale? Can they afford to live here? Do they have to live in Tocqueville or other places?
They cannot afford to live here. We have over 1,000 people who work in town every day, if you consider the national park and the businesses here, and almost all of them commute, some from as far away as Cedar City or Mesquite, and very few live here. And that's one of the things that we're trying to tackle is housing. I can't tell you how many, but quite a few people are living out of RVs out on the BLM property. And we would like to make it possible for them to move here, not just for their sake, but because we would like some new people in the town. We want some families. We want to keep this town going as we age out, because it is an older population.
Yeah. So older population, of course, we want families. And this is a problem you find all over the West, right? This affordability issue. How are you, how's Springdale tackling that?
Well, we are not in the housing business, but we did, since I've come into office, we passed a what we call a workforce housing overlay zone. So what it does is it gives density that's almost as dense as commercial zoning to residential areas if the developer will build what we call workforce housing. So those are units where at least 75% of the units have to be occupied by someone who works in the town. And they can change employers, but they have to work in the town of Springdale. So we hope that that will be incentive for developers to build those kinds of places.
Yeah.
And some of that is home ownership too, but mostly it's rentals, because in a hospitality environment like this, there's a more transient group of workers. So we really need long-term rentals more than we need home ownership here.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that echoes many gateway communities, right?
Yes.
Kind of a transient workforce, because the visitor population fluctuates.
Yeah. And it's just the nature of the hospitality business.
So. Yeah. What percentage, I imagine a very large percentage of the economy in Springdale is tied to visitation to the park?
100%.
Okay. Right. All right. I was wondering if you had anything else. Yeah.
About $80,000 a year in property tax. And the rest of our revenue all comes from visitation.
Yeah. So lodging, restaurants, what
hotel
else?
Hotel tax, resort tax, transient room tax. Those would be the where we get our revenue stream.
Yeah. I want to back up a little bit. So you moved to Springdale. At what point did you decide, well, I want to get into government? Was it the usual planning commission, city council, mayor route?
No, I shortened that a little bit.
Okay.
And it's funny, because when I decided to run for mayor, people, my friends would ask me what made me angry. And I, in fact, was not angry at all. So I got down here and we spent the first year remodeling our house. And shortly after that, I really wanted to get involved with the town. I'm here because I love the place. And so I joined the planning commission, which is an appointed position. And I became chair of the planning commission, and pretty quickly realized that in a small town, one person can make a difference. And one of the things that I noticed is that we do a really good job with the visitor experience. A lot of businesses and people paying attention to the visitor experience, but I wanted to try to work on the resident experience, because we go downriver, so to speak, for virtually everything. And I thought maybe that we could provide more amenities for residents. So, for example, we have a little medical clinic just down the hill here by Town Hall. And it was a couple that was about to retire, and we were going to lose our medical clinic. So I talked with Family Healthcare. They agreed to come and run it. And we're in the architectural planning stages of a new medical clinic. So things like that. I was trying to focus on things like that.
Yeah, that's I guess, you know, for the economy's sake, you're looking at the visitors, but residents too, right?
Yeah. Something like a medical clinic, it's certainly, they get more visitors that come as patients, but it's also a benefit for the residents.
Yeah,
you can imagine.
So you do have some infrastructure. I'm noticing a library, right?
The library is actually owned by Washington County. But the community center where it's located, it's a partnership between Washington County and the town of Springdale.
Yeah. So you didn't have anything particularly you were angry about. What did you want to accomplish when you were running for mayor?
Yeah, I wanted to do my part to keep the town of Springdale charming, because it is a charming town. It's not a typical Disneyland environment like you see at so many national parks. And I wanted to keep some amenities and provide some additional amenities for visitors. So small thing, but one of the first things I worked on, we had a cellular dead zone between Leverkin and the town of Rockville, which was a safety issue. Our police officers here are all on Verizon. And so I contacted the CEO of Verizon, and about a year and a half later, they started working right away to get licensing and towers. And now we don't have that dead zone. So we have cell service throughout that area. So those are the kinds of things I was looking at, just things that are inconveniences or problems for the residents here.
Yeah. So I guess your law enforcement, people take care of things in town, right? What about in the park? Is that handled by the Park Service?
Yes. So we in Springdale have 10 police officers, full-time police officers, which is a lot for a town of 600 people. But of course, it's because of visitors. And then the National Park has its own public safety people. And then Washington County also has public safety people. So it's not unusual with a big incident or a big search and rescue that all three agencies work together.
Yeah. You mentioned the look of the town. I've noted, I always remark when I come to Springdale, there is a definite look. And that's, I'm sure, an effort over years, if not decades.
Yes, it's something that's been going on for a long time. So we, I think, are the only municipality in the state of Utah that has a maximum size building. We don't want huge buildings. So you'll notice at our hotels, it's not one big building. There are several buildings. I think the max size for those is 8,000 square feet. Houses is 5,000 square feet, and we don't allow anything over two stories high. So just trying to keep the village environment that we think that we have.
Yeah. This, as you said earlier, contrasts with what you find in a lot of gateway communities. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot of pressure from developers, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
5 million people coming here a year to build things that are really lucrative for them that don't necessarily provide anything for our residents here. And so we're always kind of balancing that whole thing.
Yeah.
We are also, we became last year an official dark sky community.
Ah.
So it's great. And it's a little tricky when you're full of hotels and 24/7 businesses to keep that dark sky. So again, we're getting a lot of pressure to have things here that we don't necessarily want, that aren't necessarily consistent with what we want Springdale to be.
Yeah. So how do you fight that battle? How do you win that battle? Because Utah definitely tilts toward property rights, right? For example, how have you been successful? How do you want to keep being successful in that battle? Because I'm sure it is a fight.
It's all about your ordinances. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got to have the right ordinances, and you've got to follow them consistently. And towns and cities are able to do a lot as long as they're consistent with their ordinances. And, we occasionally are sued over something that someone wants to do, but as long as we followed our process, we almost always prevail.
Many cities in Utah have not been successful. There are other states that maybe tilt, the balance a little bit more, toward aesthetics, the power of ordinances. I'm thinking about Portland, places in Oregon. I guess just to follow up, Springdale has been able to be successful. I guess consistency in those ordinances.
Yes. And it's no small part of that is that there's just really not a lot of land to acquire.
Hmm.
We're, I don't remember how many square miles we have, but it's not many. So there's not a lot of property available to do the wrong thing with, so to speak.
Yeah. If you just joined us, you're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Springdale Mayor Barbara Bruno. I'm broadcasting from Springdale, a new facility here at Zion Canyon Mesa. We'll talk about that a little later in the program with the Executive Director, Logan Hebner. I want to talk a little bit about Zion National Park. Of course, portion of Springdale is very much tied to Zion National Park, I would imagine, right? Yes. Ebbs and flows, you rise and fall with the park, right? Lately, what we've heard is, I don't know how this is shaken out, you would know better than I do, that there were going to be reductions in the full-time staff at Zion and other national parks, but they were going to try to backfill that, at least for this season, with seasonal workers. I don't know where staffing is at the Zion.
Yeah, it's the superintendent of Zion National Park has said at our council meeting that the park is currently down 40 full-time employees, which is a lot because I don't think they have quite 200 full-time employees. So the park was understaffed and it was underfunded before the reductions in force. They lost some probationary employees and they got most of those back. But it's my understanding that there's still a hiring freeze on filling the empty positions. Fortunately, the 100-ish seasonal workers that they hire every year for the busy season are now coming on board. There was a period where they thought they would not be able to hire them, so they're arriving late. But the good news is they are arriving.
Okay. Of course, they're what kinds of jobs do they do?
They do everything from trail maintenance to cleaning restrooms to collecting fees at the gate. The park's priorities right now with the staffing situation, their highest priority is visitor safety, especially at pinch points like the tunnel. And then second is employee safety. Third is preservation of the natural resource. And then their last priority, which doesn't mean it's not important, but their lowest priority is collecting fees. So what we're seeing is that at the entrance gate, some days that are busy enough that all the booths would be open, they're not. They simply don't have the staff to open all the booths, which results in some backups into town. But that's a pretty minor inconvenience compared to what's happening in the park with people, you know, trying to cover each other's jobs and trying to do all that work on their own.
What's visitation like? Average for no,
it's up. So I just
mm-hmm.
heard at the Visitors Bureau meeting yesterday, the representative from the park said that in April visitation was up 14% over last year, and I think year to date it's up 11%, which is notable because last year was the second highest on record with 4.95 million. The highest was during COVID, it was 5.2 million. And so if they continue with the current trend, we'll set a new record for visitation. So a lot of people going through a single road to get into a tight little park.
That sure is. So at the height of it, what's it like? It's bumper to bumper, I guess.
Can be.
Yeah.
It can be difficult to get around the town. But we are fortunate to have the shuttle system that we have and to be an active transportation community. So I always tell people, if you're planning a trip to Zion National Park, find lodging in Springdale and you'll have your best experience because you can park your car. Hotels are required to provide parking for their guests. And you can ride the shuttle, you can walk, you can bike, you can get around without your car from there. So instead of sitting in traffic on State Road 9, you're better off to hang out up here. We have lots of great restaurants.
Certainly do. So there has been in the past some criticism of the Mighty Five ad campaign. Some people think that we overran our Big Five parks. I don't know what you feel.
I was not involved in government here when they were running that campaign, but it appears it was very successful. And I think that part of the higher visitation is just the way the world's changing and more remote work and that kind of thing. But certainly the Mighty Five campaign was very successful. And then also just having the Olympics in Salt Lake City, because I heard from the mayor of Moab that because they were using Delicate Arch in the ads for the Olympics, it increased the number of visitors to the Moab area incrementally, and they didn't expect that. It was an unforeseen consequence. So I think that's, you know, if somebody's visiting Utah, Southern Utah, one of the national parks, chances are they'll visit all of them. Mm-hmm. So I think just visitation to Utah in general has been part of why we get so many people down here. But Zion is also a very popular park and it's a lot of people's favorite, including me.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
It's just such spectacular geology. It's amazing. And like I said earlier, there's just something magical about it. And when I talk with people who live here, who are not from here, so to speak, they were drawn by the national park, by nature and by its glory and just by the magical feel and the serenity. Even now with all the visitors in the park, it's not unusual to go on a hike, especially over on the east side where you don't run into anybody.
Yeah, that's a good point. If people are concerned about overcrowding in the main drag, there are places in the park you can You can go.
Yeah, it's a large park. It's not nearly as big as Yellowstone, but it is large, and there are places you can go when you want to stay away from the crowds.
Yeah.
But sitting on a visitor use committee at the park, I do know that almost everybody who comes to Zion visits the scenic canyon at least once, and so that's why that's such a pinch point.
Yeah. We're hearing the news lately that foreign tourism in the U.S. is down. I don't know what you're seeing here in Zion. You're seeing the usual, I know Germans are big travelers. I don't know. You have a lot of nationalities coming through?
Again, anecdotally and not statistically, I'm not seeing as many international visitors. And I've seen in the news that European visitation from international destinations is not down a lot other than Canada. So I would expect that we're experiencing the same thing here.
So at least anecdotally, kind of holding steady except for Canadian yes. visitors. Okay. What about Utahns?
Yeah.
Lots. We have, some people I talk to, grew up in Utah, never been to Zion, never been to the parks. You get Utahns in here?
Yeah, I was one of those Utahns. As a child, my family did not come to national parks. We did a lot of camping and fishing, but kind of closer to home. So I think there are still Utahns. I'm in St. George and I'm surprised because somebody who's cutting my hair or doing something like that has never been over here, doesn't know where Springdale is. But we get a lot of Utah visitors, a lot of day trippers that come over from all over Washington County, King County, Iron County. And then St. George attracts a lot of northern Utahns, as you know, for the weather and sort of the activities. And most of them visit Zion at least one day of their trip. So we do get a lot of Utahns.
We have just a couple of minutes left in this conversation. I want to do, concerns and hopes for the future. Start with Zion National Park, really the park system in general. Even before this current administration, the budget cuts, I think declining money put into the parks, right? And so that causes on some ongoing infrastructure issues. Are there concerns about Zion that you have going forward?
Yes, because as I stated earlier, the park was underfunded. Their budgets haven't really increased to keep up with inflation. They are fortunate. I don't know how many parks have this. I know some do and some don't, but Zion is fortunate to have a nonprofit organization called the Zion Forever Project that does fundraising and helps with some of those infrastructure projects as well as just fundraising in general. They're the ones that run the bookstore there, and it's a very busy, lucrative bookstore. So they're fortunate to have some assistance like that. And then the state of Utah and Washington County are right now in the process of giving them some money to put a sewer line in from the Grotto Trailhead down to the visitor center because the septic system is on the brink of failure there. So they do get some outside help, but certainly they're underfunded from the federal government. And I'm very concerned because of the numbers of visitors. I don't think that's going to change, but I'm concerned about the infrastructure holding up and being able to accommodate people in a safe and healthy way.
Just a couple more questions for Barbara Bruno before we do go to break. So as I was saying, concerned about an aging population, you want families, kids to be able to stay. You talked about housing, that's a big part of it, right? What else can be done?
Well, so Springdale is a town of fewer than 600 full-time residents. And then we have about 30% of our housing that is people's second or third or eighth home. So I'm seeing a trend again, anecdotally, but houses that are occupied by full-time residents are being sold and part-time people are buying those houses up. We have an elementary school here. That's a fantastic little school and it is down to just over 30 students now. They like to keep that at 50 or more. And most of the students who are at that school are not people who live here. They are children of people who come up to work, which is great. So we'd like to see more families. We think that they add a lot to communities. And again, we're an older population and we'd like to see the town of Springdale not become just a gateway to the national park, but remain a community where people actually live and play and work.
Oh, give you last word here. What else would you like to say?
Just want to reiterate that Springdale is a wonderful place and it's a great place to visit. And for your best experience, stay at our lodging.
All right. Wonderful. We've been talking with Springdale Mayor Barbara Bruno. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank you. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Zion Canyon Mesa Executive Director Logan Hebner. Hope you stay with us through this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we are at Zion Canyon Mesa in Springdale. We have talked to Springdale Mayor Barbara Bruno in the first part of the program, and we are going to bring in now Zion Canyon Mesa Executive Director Logan Hebner. We thank Mayor Bruno and Logan Hebner. Thank you so much for joining us.
What a pleasure. And I'm a fan, Tom. It's an honor to be
here. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much. So we want to talk about Zion Canyon Mesa. This is a new facility, new program, right?
Yes. We've been at it for a while.
Oh, you have? Okay. All right.
This is our coming out party.
This coming out party. All right. We want to talk about that. We're broadcasting from this facility up on a mesa.
How's it look to you, Tom?
It looks great.
Right?
The view is wonderful. We're here in Springdale, beautiful. I was going to say a beautiful part of Springdale, but really there's no not beautiful part.
Correct.
But there's a lot of interesting stuff that you've done, Logan Hebner. I just went to your LinkedIn page.
Oh, that's more than I've done in and a couple years. What does it say?
Well, we'll talk about that as we go along. First of all, let's talk a little bit about Zion Canyon Mesa. What is this?
We're an arts and humanities residency center. And the people who were doing this before me scored this astonishing 26 acres on a peninsula kind of above Springdale, where, as you notice, Springdale kind of vanishes. No offense, Barb Bruno, but it's we're alone. Springdale's gone. Through some miracle, sonic miracle, it's quiet up here. There can be literally 10,000 people in town and you can't hear them. So we have this amazing place where people can come and both work on projects and focus without interruption, but also be inspired by being graced, surrounded by Zion Canyon.
So I know you have residencies, right? You have a podcast.
We have a whole kind of array of programming, but our primary focus is residency. But we have a series of podcasts. We've produced a number of workshops, a lecture series in partnership with Zion Forever. Thank you, Natalie Britt. And we're hopefully trying to become or intending to become a hub for Utah's creative community and beyond. But we're very focused on Utah at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. You were telling me before we went on the air about a few of the podcasts. Just you give me an overview of what you try to do.
To be honest, we were a little low on funds and looking for a way to start a flame that people would start to gather around, something to get attention. And it seemed, as we'll get to later, I had done the book about the Southern Paiute. I had done interviews and I understood interviews and the work that it takes. Well, you of course understand it takes a lot of work to interview someone. It takes research, and obviously you've done yours. Thank you. And I thought, well, maybe a podcast is a way to start getting word out about what we're doing. And I knew nothing about them, but our intern at the time, Ben Kilborn, knew everything about them, you know, the stuff we needed to buy, the subscriptions we needed online. And so our first podcast was with Barry Lopez, the one of America's finest writers.
Good get, right? Yeah.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. And well, thank you, Jim Ayton. They were friends, mm-hmm. and I'm friends with Jim, and he very graciously set it up. And it turned out to be one of his last interviews before he died. And so then we did a series on the helper community, going from the coal mining town to sort of a ghost town and now an artist community. We did a whole series on that. Did a one with Russell Daniels, a photographer from Salt Lake. Did one on the Lake Powell Pipeline, a whole series about water along the west with Powell and then the Colorado River Compact. More to engage the moment, we did one with the true genius, Audrey Tong from Taiwan, who's creating real-time democracy there. It's profound what she's doing. And if you ever need to feel good about humanity, just listen to Mark Johnson. Have you watched any of those Playing for Change videos?
No.
Where they have, they go all away, all around the world recording musicians on the same song with these beautiful backgrounds. And he was an engineer from New York who realized that it was technically possible to do that. So he spend an hour with him, as I did, and you'll just feel better about humanity because he's just a vibrant person. Anyway, these the one that got attention, though, was the one we went down into Glen Canyon at super low water and visited all those beautiful places. And that caught somebody's eye. And we ended up getting some enough money to fire up the construction again. So the podcasts were a way of announcing ourselves and sort of, if people want to understand what Zion Candy Mesa is about, go to our website and go to podcasts. We're also known as Insight on iTunes and Spotify. And check out the array of podcasts, and that'll tell you, that'll sort of outline our interests.
All right. ZionCanyonMesa.org, is it?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. People can check you out. And thank you for hosting here. Not only that, thank you for hosting StoryCorps.
Oh, my God. What fun.
Yeah. A lot of fun. By the way, let me do a shout out for StoryCorps. Go to upr.org. And click on the StoryCorps. Still slots available in St. George, I guess through most of the rest of the month. Love to have you come and record a story with your loved one in St. George. So I want to get into your very interesting bio, Logan Hebner. Let's start with the American Legislative Exchange. Understand this started with the Soviet-American Walk.
Tell
me about that.
Well, it started with the Great Peace March in 1986. Okay. My wife, when she was 19, walked from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. With 500 other people and that was in the middle of the Cold War and the heightened nuclear concerns. And hello, Angie. And that organization, when they finished their walk, they realized that to really make it effective, they had to do the same in the Soviet Union. So she was part of the organization that organized a walk from Leningrad to Moscow. That I was a participant on, and it was an amazing event. Again, Gorbachev had just come in. There was still the Cold War was still hot, but Gorbachev was and Reagan were working together. It was just an electric event, capped with a concert with Bonnie Raitt, Carlos Santana, James Taylor, and a host of really indescribably horrible official Soviet rock bands. Their underground rock bands were amazing, but from that event. I was watching carefully about where I was just kind of soaking in what the Soviet Union was about and realized that they could really use direct sort of friction with American democracy. And my father was the Speaker of the House for the state of Delaware. And so I'd made friends with some Estonian parliament members. And I said, hey, would you like to come to America and sit in on the Delaware state legislature? For a while. It's a more complicated story than that, but I had a Supreme Soviet member that I was taking across America and trying to figure out what was affecting him, and nothing seemed to faze him except being in a small state legislature. So I said, aha, that's the scale model that people understand, state legislatures. So when I was in Estonia, I was right ahead of James Baker with the Reagan delegation, and I was mistaken for a member of that delegation. So many of the things that I've done in my life have been by allowing other people to misunderstand things about me. And so I got calls from the Latvian and Lithuanian vice presidents saying, are you the American arranging exchanges for your government? And it was, yes, I am. So I ended up having those meetings and putting together an organization that brought a whole series of delegations from newly released parliaments to state legislatures to learn about American. Boy, that was really rewarding. And I became a real patriot at that time, really feeling the appreciation of these Soviet parliament members or ex-Soviet, really trying to figure out what the responsibilities that they would take on by in a democracy. As the Supreme Soviet guy, Vladimir Fedosov, said, I have never seen 50 people in a room together trying to make a difficult decision. So, it was a wonderful run. And when I met with the USIA about it and thought they were going to fund me, they put a bunch of money on the table and then said, well, you haven't existed for 5 years, so we can't fund you. So we're taking over the program. And that was fine. It got going. And the last one was with the Tibetan Parliament in Exile And as you probably know, there's a substantial Tibetan exile population in Salt Lake City, and they were pivotal in helping put that together.
Yeah.
So yeah, a whole bunch of different parliaments bringing them to the United States. Very rewarding.
Yeah, fascinating. Would I have to move through the your bio a little faster than we maybe want to. You know, we probably take an hour with it. But just one more follow up on this. Russia won in a very different way, right? But I guess still democracies in Estonia and the other Baltic states, right?
Yeah, the Baltics they really peeled off very nicely.
Yeah.
Very beautifully.
Let's move to what brought you out to Springdale.
Look around. That was it.
Okay.
I was living in Alta, and I was the assistant to the mayor up there. Shout out to the late, great Bill Levitt. And we had this wonderful chef who would bring us down in the 70s to the Shakespeare Festival, which was happening then. And I was from back east, from Delaware, so the whole West thing was eye-popping. And we were driving over this Highway 14 to Duck Creek Village in a full moon. And I was just looking down on this place, and it was so profound. Something happened in the 70s. Something just went, my God, what is that place? And I managed to find my way back and just fell in love with the place. We had a high-flying investment group that was going to buy Grafton and turn it into a ghost town. And thank God that didn't happen, because we just would have screwed it up. But there was that fell apart. But there was literally a for sale sign on the Bitten Spur. It looked like a small town jail. It was a cinder block box. But we noticed that there was no bar or Mexican restaurant in town. I had no notion ever in my life of opening a bar or a restaurant. But if it's what you want to do, you'll go anywhere to do it. But if it's where you want to live, you'll do anything to live there. So that's why I started the Bitten Spur.
Shout out to our event this evening, the Bitten Spur.
Right.
UPR is having a fundraising event. So I'm not sure if we have slots open, but go to upr.org and check that out. Love to have your support for UPR. Again, I feel like we're racing through this. A very interesting bio, but let's continue. Because you have so many things here. You're author of Southern Paiute: A Portrait. How did that come about?
Well, I met the Southern Paiute here in a very real way. Well, first of all, you live here, and it's so the whole Colorado Plateau, and you begin to wonder about the people who really lived here, and so you start learning about them, and wondering about them. And then having a bar is a very real way to meet Indians, because alcohol and Indians is a whole other conversation. But being so I became very intimate in a very real way with a number of guys. And then the Kaibab Paiute were offered $100 million by Bechtel in 1989 to host what would have been the largest hazardous waste incinerator in the West. So right between the Class A air of Zion National Park and Grand Canyon would have been the largest hazardous waste incinerator. And this is a pretty poverty-stricken tribe, offered $100 million right off the bat. So I sort of inserted myself into that process to help fight it, and became friends with Vivian Jake, who is one of the brightest people I've ever met and wisest. And she and I became friends. And when her mother died, Lucille, I wanted to see interviews. I said, somebody surely, because it's not ideas. It's a way people are, and the humor and love and patience and just the way they were together was unique and new to me. And so I said, well, somebody just talk to Lucille. And it turned out that nobody had, except for a couple of PhDs who wanted their very specific thing. So I just very quietly started talking to some of the elders. I have no anthropology background. I've no nothing, but I had a recorder and I just started recording stories. And somehow that snowballed from a few interviews to a local exhibit with my good friend, Michael Plyler. Those beautiful photograph portraits that he did in there. And thanks to John Alley, who was the Utah State University press editor, who saw the exhibit, it became that book. And it was a marvelous 10 years of sitting at the feet of these marvelous elders and just hearing their stories. My different take on it was, instead of going to them and asking them specific questions for my PhD, I never got a degree or anything out of this. It's like, well, tell me about your life. You know, Tom, what are you thinking about? What's, you know, who's your mom? Who's your dad? And that led to very interesting interviews and that book.
I wish we had time to get into it. Maybe a different conversation for a different time, right? Again. Yeah. But some beautiful portraits here. Right?
Michael Plyler.
And then you just sat down and talked with these folks, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And they were usually tough interviews because it's like, oh, you're white and you take everything, you kill everything. And it's like, yeah, there's that. And apologies. But for one thing, they're really bad at staying angry. And they're just a joyful people generally. And I did a lot of research. And again, we could talk about how research makes an interview valuable. So I was usually able to bring something to them that they hadn't seen from the white side of their history. You'd have a photo and it would turn out to be their grandfather. So it's funny to see the old Hiller's photos and the classic photos where there's John Wesley Powell and an Indian. But then you go to the house and that's Taugu or Coal Creek John. And they have that same photo in their house as their ancestor. So you do the homework, you respect, you listen, and it just kind of, you've been involved in projects. It's just kind of the wind hit the sails and it just kind of happened.
Yeah. You just listen, right? Just listen.
Well, my wife, I used to joke when I'd open when we'd give talks, I said, my wife thinks it's hilarious that I'm making my living by listening right now. Because I'm and to be honest, I wasn't really listening. I knew I was recording. I was just watching to see if they were interested in what they were talking about. And if they were, I'd keep it going. And if they weren't, I'd change the subject. Mm-hmm. I just kept the interviews interesting for them. And that's what is the core of that book. What were they interested in?
Yeah. Oh, 2 or 3 minutes is all we have left. Do the 2 or 3 minute version of Green Box.
Green Box, brother-in-law, alcoholic. How do I give him $100 that he can't spend on alcohol? And I started thinking about it, and that evolved into a realizing that it's real-time data, and that there's a space. It's about how you can control. I know it sounds big brotherish, especially these days, but it evolved in the idea of how to any funder can control how any beneficiary spends its money. That goes from me to my brother-in-law, but it also turns out that it goes to the $1.6 trillion in benefit programs, where we didn't just have a right to how people spend their money, but you know, the government, our tax money, but an obligation. And it also turned out to be a way to split off taxes in real time. So online taxes, there were billions of dollars left on the table. And oddly enough, it wasn't quashed by government. It was, I stepped back from it when, after the Republican setup in Massachusetts with Governor Baker passed a law saying, we want to do this. And we were all excited. And then the guys that actually split the money off, First Data, MasterCard, they all said, this is impossible to do. In the meantime, of course, they're doing it quietly amongst themselves. So it was me versus the Electronic Transmissions Association. And I didn't think I was going to win that fight, but it's still out there. It's still the idea. It was a great several years of traveling the world and hanging out with tech people.
Yeah. So now you got Zion Canyon Mesa, right? That's your focus.
Oh my goodness, yes.
So zioncanyonmesa.org, check it out. We're broadcasting from this. Just 30 seconds here at the end. You probably got something else, some other things on the bucket list. Anything you want to mention?
No, this is an unexpected honor and opportunity to create something of lasting value in Utah for Utah's creative community. The idea is to become, Utah's unique in that we're a small town. The same donor families support the same 20 or so great organizations. So why not create a place where those organizations can come and woodshed their ideas? I've talked to the people at the Shakespeare Festival, Ryrie Woodbury, Spy Hop, Pioneer Theater, Kayenta. All these people have creative folks that come through, and why not bring them down here to work on things, to interact with each other? But as you know, it's also a world-class site. So we're going to be bringing in world-class people, which includes some scientists. And so the Utah creative community will be mixing with world-class people in all these different, this array of disciplines. And as you can see, it's a world-class site. And so it deserves to become a world-class operation. And what an honor that it's landed to me to help bring this forward. And I'm doing the best I can to do that.
All right, good place to leave. We've been talking with Logan Hebner, Executive Director of Zion Canyon Mesa. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tom. What a pleasure.
And thank you for hosting. Thanks to Barbara Bruno, Springdale Mayor previously. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
Greetings, fellow Earthlings. Skywatcher Leo T here. It's one sky, many cultures. As the spring and summer stars are peeking up over the mountains or sandstone rims in the east like the summer triangle, oh, it's also the summer swan. It continues to make its appearance in the east. One star after another blinks up. The first in view is Vega. It stands out brightly low, blue and white in the northeast after nightfall. About an hour later is Deneb, Big Deneb, which has a whole beautiful twinkling of stars around it. Lower left of Vega, and the third coming up is Altair the Eagle, which is white and big, shows up far to Vega's lower right by about 11 o'clock or so. Fire in the sky, the Eta Aquariid meteor shower has been roaring and peaking. Lots of people across several states saw fireball drop in Saturday night. Excited people took photos and videos of the exquisite fireball coming down. The intrepid meteorite came down near Yellowstone Park. No word yet if any meteor hunters have found possible remnants, but that might take a while, if at all. Let's get going into space. Do you remember the Psyche heavy metal probe that we've been reporting on since it blasted off in 2023 and uses Xeon thrusters on its way to Mars to a heavy metal asteroid in the belt? Well, the Sci-Fi thruster suffered a glitch on the way to Mars, where it will need the thrusters to adjust its trajectory as it catches a gravity assist from Mars and head out to the metal-rich asteroid. NASA says the Psyche solar-winged craft had an anomaly concerning its propulsion system while nearly 150 million miles from Earth and its astro controllers. The problem is a decrease in fuel pressure within Psyche's solar electric propulsion setup, which led the team to power off the thrusters until they can find a solution. However, the agency also affirms that these thrusters can remain off until at least mid-June before JPL Astros adjust Psyche's trajectory toward its asteroid target. It's got to go around Mars and catch a little bit of a thrust boost from Mars first. The electric propulsion system has two identical fuel lines, and the team may decide to switch the backup fuel line on to resume thrusting. Like the probe itself, Psyche's propulsion system is blazing new trails. This is the first time the mission team says that this specific mechanism of zipping through space has been used on a probe beyond lunar orbit. In essence, sunlight collected with Psyche's large solar arrays gets converted into electricity, which then powers up the spacecraft's four thrusters. Once powered up with enough sunlight-derived energy, the thrusters, called Hall thrusters, use electromagnetic fields to expel charged atoms of xenon gas that are stored in tanks aboard the spacecraft. Also in deep space, NASA's Juno probe is exploring Jupiter and its moons, finding a flurry of new discoveries that have taken us below the surface of Io, one of the volcanic moons of the giant, and found some lava, and into the world of cyclones playing bumper cars at the North Jovian Pole. See JPL's photo on the Skywatcher Facebook page. And a spacecraft launched by the Soviet Union in 1972 is supposed to come crashing back down into the Earth's atmosphere around May 10th. Nobody knows where it will land. If you are listening on Sunday to this program, you may know where the Cosmos 482 came down by then. The spacecraft was launched with its twin to Venus. The twin made a landing on Venus before being crushed by the atmosphere, but it took some photos. The one that we're talking about, though, has been slowly falling lower in its orbit over the last 53 years that it fell into, and luckily it's only going 150 miles an hour at this point and may even deploy its parachute. History in front of us. And more history going on right in front of us. The Artemis II mega rocket, set to launch NASA's next astronauts to the moon in 2026, is almost completely assembled. The giant space launch system. The rocket continues to grow inside NASA's vehicle assembly building. Technicians at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida stacked the rocket's second stage onto the launch vehicle Thursday, May 1st. The interim cryogenic propulsion stage is responsible for carrying the Orion spacecraft and the crew the rest of the way into orbit around the Earth and then sending them on their way to the moon. The rocket will launch the Artemis II mission with NASA astronauts Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, and Christina Cook, as well as Canadian Space Agency astronaut Jeremy Hansen. The quartet are flying the second installment of NASA's Artemis program, which aims to establish a permanent presence on the moon as a technology springboard to one day land on Mars. And that's what Artemis III is going to do. It's going to land on the moon. As it's many cultures, one sky, let's check in with ourselves. What sky stories do you have? What spiral or cloud of stars or planets or hangars in the sky do you have stories about? Make one up. Post them on the Skywatcher Facebook page and listen to UPR, KRCL, KZMU every week and read about it in the Wayne and Garfield County Insider newspaper delivered to every post office box in these counties. So keep looking up, look around, and get lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.